Each day, the amount of data in the world increases by 2.5 quintillion bytes. That there is more data is not in doubt. Whether we'll be able to harness that data to affect our everyday lives is up to the women and men that craft insights into impact, inform perspectives into effective policy. Welcome to Steps to Value, the HIMSS podcast that looks at people and processes, information and technology, as they work together to transform the delivery of healthcare. In today's episode, we explore how to craft data into collective action with Jessica Kahn, Senior Expert in Public Sector Health IT and Data at McKinsey & Company, and recent recipient of HIMSS's Most Influential Women in Health IT Award. In her time as Director for Medicaid's Data and Systems Group, Jessica oversaw $5 billion in annual federal spending for state Medicaid IT and data projects. Through her leadership of the Medicaid EHR Incentive Program, over 202,000 providers received more than $12 billion in incentive payments to adopt, implement, upgrade, and meaningfully use federally certified EHR systems. Today, we talk to Jessica about what her leadership experiences have taught her about consensus-driven outcomes, data's powerful impact on the patients' and providers' experience of their healthcare, and how answering an ad in a college newspaper truly changed her life. All that and more coming up.
HIMSS Health IT Career Services is your complete resource for personal and professional growth. Whether you're new to health technology or looking to transition within the field, HIMSS has the tools and resources to help advance your career. Find answers to your career questions at HIMSS.org.
Jess Kahn is senior expert at McKinsey & Company's Washington, D.C. office. She specializes in state Medicaid and social services programs, public sector data, and technology. Jess is a 2018 recipient of HIMSS's Most Influential Women in Health IT Award. Jess, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on your award.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
So, you've had experiences in your career across a number of different sectors, the nonprofit sector, government, private sector. What would you describe as the thread that ties all of those experiences together? And what advice would you give to other professionals as they build their networks across multiple industry segments and sectors like you did?
Sure. I actually have a pretty straightforward and obvious thread, and maybe even two, that go across my career. One is that it has always been healthcare related, and by health I do mean the broad definition of health, which includes housing and food stability, mental health, as well as clinical health. And the other one would be is that I've always worked with vulnerable populations, so those who are underserved or low income and or have multiple complex needs, both in domestic and international settings. So I've been pretty consistent across all of my positions in those two focus areas. In terms of advice, I would say there is something to working on something you're passionate about. And there is always a benefit to changing your perspective and seeing the work that you do from a different perspective, which is what, you know, moving in different roles within government, state or federal, private sector or nonprofit have allowed me to do. But those common threads, understanding how important I feel that healthcare and wellness are to human beings, and also understanding my own motivations around wanting to serve vulnerable populations. I myself was a Medicaid baby. Had my parents had, were it not for Medicaid, would have been uninsured from my own birth. And so I feel very passionate about that. And I think that that's an important thing to keep people going. These are not easy topics. And when you work on something that really matters to you, that tends to get you through and to keep you growing.
Well, let's talk about some of those experiences and initiatives that you've led. In your multiple roles, you've led a number of initiatives that have focused on the successful sharing of health data between entities, be they public or private, state or federal. We're always interested in process on steps mm-hmm. of value, and would love to get your perspective on the completion of those initiatives. What would surprise people as being easier than expected to accomplish? What would surprise people as being harder?
Sure. And then there are the things that everybody agrees are hard, right? I would say what would surprise people as being easier, I think, is actually the technology. That's not to say that it isn't sometimes challenging, but it has just moved in leaps and bounds. And when we think about where public sector data could be in comparison to private sector data, how big data moves, how it's collected and synthesized and transferred for a number of use cases, it's much easier now than it was even 5 years ago. So from a technology perspective, it's usually a question of getting everybody on the same page about which technology and standards to use. But it's surprising, I think, in the end, when people realize that that is not the problem. The problem, the things that are harder than expected, tend to be the people side of things. Understanding what it means to be stewards of data and to want to share it for their greater good, but they're also trying to protect privacy. And it's really working together across territory and turf that tends to be a lot harder than people would assume, especially because most of the time these are all entities that have the same mission. They all are trying to improve the greater public good. And so you wouldn't expect the people problems to be as much of a challenge as they are. But that tends to be more laborious and need a lot more time and attention than the actual IT parts of it. And then the parts that I think everybody understands are tricky and remain tricky is the legality side and all the agreements that have to go with that. Everyone knows that's going to be hard, and sure enough, it's hard.
So as we talked about what we were hoping to have a conversation about in this interview, we talked about the confidence gap. And I'm wondering if you could explain for our listeners what the confidence gap is and from your perspective, how you think confidence gap impacts professionals in the healthcare and the technology industries.
Yeah, that's a great question because one might think those two things are unrelated, but I definitely see them as connected. So the confidence gap is essentially, and I'm summarizing research done by many talented people, the confidence gap is essentially related to gender and the thinking that in predominantly American culture, though not exclusively, women often are less confident about putting themselves forward in professional settings, about reaching for jobs until they feel like they could already do it. Oh, I can't do that job, or I'm not ready for that job, without thinking that maybe this could be a stretch goal, or they might be 60 or 70% of the way there, compared to, on average, men who are more likely to overestimate their readiness and to be willing to take greater risks in raising their hand and speaking up and being more assertive in expressing their views and in moving up the ladder professionally. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of research that looks at where this starts from very young ages and how if people perceive it. If you have two candidates and one comes off as more self-confident and the other one doesn't, oftentimes people who are doing that interviewing might mistake this self-confidence for some sort of confirmation of skill sets when actually the two candidates could have the same skill set. So it's something to be aware of, whether it's an issue that you struggle with or not, and on both genders. The reason I think this is relevant in our field, in healthcare technology, is on the one hand, most healthcare providers, if you include nurses, are female. And now I think it's been several years that the medical school incoming student population has tipped to the majority female as well. And yet when you look on the technology, leadership tends to be predominantly male, setting aside kind of the COO or HR roles in large tech companies or small tech companies, you tend to still see predominantly men in those roles. So when you bring those two things together, and you think about what skills it takes to be successful in healthcare and in technology, and how many of those skills rely a lot of group interaction, rely upon group interaction versus small teams that go off and maybe code and then come back together. They're very different interactions, and understanding how to blend those two things together and either as an individual fall prey to the confidence gap as a professional woman or as a professional male or woman, not mistake more obvious and external indications of confidence, speaking to a skill set that somebody who's more quiet or more reserved might not also have, and which of those things really brings value in the role that you're looking for. We're definitely, and HIMSS has been a real leader in trying to quantify the degree of a gender equality gap overall in healthcare IT, and I do think that the confidence gap plays a part of what is driving the gender inequality issue.
You mentioned that this impact starts at a young age. Any words of advice for parents as they're trying to actively parent their sons and daughters to be able to achieve all that they want to achieve?
Sure. As the mother of two daughters and a son, I've put a lot of thought into that and talked to a lot of my peers about that. It is from the simple, which is encouraging our daughters to look into STEM. And the reason for that isn't just to start to create a better gender balance in science and mathematics and engineering, but also because one of the key tenets of STEM is questioning. It's curiosity. It's hypotheses. It's putting out what you think might be right and be willing to question that and have that question. And so it legitimizes not knowing the answer, but being curious and asking it from a very young age. And then it's also more complex things about, you know, watching the language that we use when it comes to how assertive young boys and girls are in the classroom or in leadership opportunities. We still sometimes would see, you know, young boys who try to take over, they're often referred to as showing leadership, and young girls are considered bossy when they actually might be doing the same thing. And so I think it's important to encourage them to validate leadership, obviously also helping them learn to share at younger ages, but to validate leadership and tendencies towards leadership in different ways, not just the more vocal and obvious ones, but also people who quietly assert ideas that are important to the group, and to help them build their confidence in speaking up. There are obviously places in the world for introverts and extroverts, both professionally and in people's personal lives, but more and more, I think, to have a leadership role in the kind of fields that we do, at least in the professional setting, people need to feel comfortable in public speaking, comfortable in their ability to be persuasive, and to be able to assert and own their own creativity and their ideas. And there are lots of tools and techniques that people can learn to do that. And we just need to make sure we're encouraging both boys and girls to adopt those tools.
So I'm hoping we can learn a little bit more about yourself and your background. You described yourself as a Medicaid baby. And I'm wondering if you could speak to how you first got into the health sector. What drove that interest? What would you describe as your origin story being?
First health, and then how health IT, how it evolved into health IT versus going a more clinical route. So obviously I was aware of and grateful for the benefits that were available for my parents when I was younger, but didn't really think about it in terms of my own career until I was a freshman in college at the University of Texas at Austin. And there was, like at most schools, a little college newspaper. And I was flipping through it. This was probably my first 2 months on campus. And there was an ad where they were asking for student volunteers to come and work at a pediatric AIDS clinic for the sole purpose of holding the babies. That there were babies there and young children there, and we know how important that kind of physical contact is. Mm-hmm. And they were actually just looking for people to come and hold them. And I was blown away by that was something we even had to ask for, that there weren't enough people to do that. And I got very involved and volunteered and eventually even worked with that organization my whole college time. And it really got me hooked on this idea that there are things that I can bring to bear. And I found it so personally rewarding, not just going and sitting and holding them, but eventually becoming an advocate for those children when they were hospitalized and becoming very close to them. And this was at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And so it was really quite a challenge. And so that really got me hooked on healthcare. And I became a Peace Corps volunteer in maternal child health in Africa. The IT side actually came when I got back, and after I'd finished graduate school, I was working both in Louisiana and in Maryland on HIV/AIDS, and noticing that the patients that we were serving or providing access to these services for were getting care in a number of different places. They would go for housing or behavioral health treatment or clinical treatment or disease management, a whole myriad of services, and I had no data on that. All I knew is like that these services were there and they were contracted with the state for funding, but we had no way to weave together that picture of where people were going to services, how often, what was the better way to do it, were there gaps, what was working, what wasn't working. It was incredibly frustrating. And somebody in the federal government had created an open source tool called CareWare, which to my knowledge is still around, that they made available to states to help them track people's service utilization across those programs for the purposes of monitoring the program and understanding where people needed additional services or what was under and overutilized. And so I moved forward in Maryland to have our program, the HIV Services Program, adopt CareWare, which was not overly popular, particularly with the large providers who already had their own identifiers and their own ways of tracking the people that came to them for services. But we did make it mandatory, and I think it did provide a foundational data set on how those programs wove together. So my foray into IT and to that level of data collection actually was because, as somebody overseeing for those services, I wanted that data. I needed it for programmatic reasons. And I had to learn about open source, and I had to learn about unique identifiers and all of those things as an actual direct user. And then I went on to have some more formalized training and some more additional work beyond that. But I think, again, what makes me passionate about it is because I knew like what that pre and post felt like, having data and not having data at a really critical time for a very important population.
So you mentioned some of the environmental factors that we're seeing from a gender perspective in the healthcare industry. In your time in the healthcare environment, in the IT environment, where do you see we've made progress? Where do you see we still have challenges to overcome?
Right. So remembering that majority of my career is in government, I still think that we have a long way to go in terms of IT leadership in government, be it local, state, or federal. There are some, but they are certainly the minority. If you look at, for example, the census of state CIOs, chief information officers, you can count on one hand or less the number that are female. You might see a lot of deputies, but there are very few that are female. And, you know, to do justice to the diversity question, they're not very diverse on many other factors as well. So I think there's still, at the top leadership vision perspective, I'm still not seeing women there at the proportion one would expect population-wise. Where I do see improvement is in more of the startup world. There are a lot of really brilliant women in software engineering, and I think it's hard to convince people to go into public sector IT as a whole, just because of the pay scale and a lot of other perceived issues. But, you know, I do definitely see some improvement in that field, in the startup side and in the private sector IT world. And there's a lot of press about that. And HIMSS, again, has done a lot of surveying of its membership to understand where there's still room to grow. But it's still, I think, leaps and bounds of where it is in actual public sector leadership, unfortunately.
So you mentioned HIMSS's Women in Health IT initiatives, and one of the focuses of that is on mentorship. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your own mentor experiences, advice that you got from mentors early on. How did that advice impact you? Is it similar to advice that you share with those that you have the opportunity to mentor?
Yes and no. I do think there's some things that have improved generationally. You know, I got advice, everything from you should wear pantyhose when you go to meetings to you're a little over. Somebody called me arrogant once because I assumed that my position merited an office when all of my peers, male peers, were in an office and I was the only one in a cubicle. So there was a little bit at the beginning for people whose opinions I really valued that I had to sort of think through and decide how to reject. But there was a lot that was incredibly valuable, both in watching some of my female mentors, how they interacted in public settings, how they set the stage really for how they wanted people to interact with them and what made them successful, how they used their gender difference to their advantage, driving towards consensus as opposed to falling on their sword and feeling like it's either their way or had to be a personal win. Sometimes giving their ideas away, if it moves the ball forward for the greater good, then they didn't need to claim it. So watch some of that, had to make peace with some of that. And it certainly got the same advice that I always give about following your bliss. I do think it's really important. You spend so much time at work. And if you have an opportunity to find a field that you enjoy, you should think about what really makes you happy. So if you're in healthcare IT, do you want to actually be at a provider site where you feel like you are touching distance from the patients that you are serving? Do you want to be at a state or federal site where you're looking at the policy levers that are available? Do you want to be on the technology side where you're helping to be creative and generate new innovative ideas that might help improve their patient care or exchange of data? Like, but figure out where's the right level for you, and that might change over time, but it's important to kind of self-calibrate what you find rewarding and self-rewarding, because it's not always going to come from a pat on the back from above. So think about what makes you, on your own, feel the glow, as I sometimes would call it. So advice I give, generally, I tell, if it's a woman, but this would apply likewise to some of the men that I mentor, which is be unapologetic about your intelligence, which is sit at the table with your arms on the table and not in a chair. Don't wait to see if it's your turn to sit at the table. You need to assume that you have a voice and a place at the table, unless there's some hugely obvious sign that you should be one of the people sitting in the back against the wall. But sometimes you have to sort of put yourself out there. Look for mentors and sponsors. They're not the same thing, and they're both really important. Understanding who's going to help you network and shape your career, where a mentor might do those things, but also can be the person who's very real with you to say, well, between those two jobs, you know, which of these actually is going to bring you more personal satisfaction? And they don't really have any skin in the game in terms of, like, you all are the same employer, and if you decline an opportunity they're giving you, it's personal. So I think it's important to have both. Oh, this is a favorite topic. I mean, I think there's a lot of things to say, but mostly, and I think this is one of the things I enjoy about him's perspective here, is a mentor shouldn't be something that's a nice to have. It should be something that you should expect to have in your career, unless, you know, that you're in a career where this is relevant. But I do think people should proactively identify a mentor in every job they're in, figure out who are their sponsors, and have those be part of their professional growth path. It shouldn't be something that you wait for your job to identify. They have a mentor program or somebody else offers it up. If you are interested in growing and in being self-aware as you grow, then you should look for those things. Look for those opportunities. There are always people willing to pay it forward. I got tremendous support with all three of my children as a professional woman. So one thing I always tend to do is reach out to women who I see are expecting in the workplace or who are about to adopt in the workplace, and give them my lessons learned on what made that transition less painful, because I don't think you can make it painless. You can make it less painful. That's just one area that really people were really kind to me, and I think I always try to pay it forward. But there's a little bit of going after what you need and not waiting for it to drop in your lap that I always try to counsel also.
Well, I'm hoping, Jesse, you have time for one more question. Great. This is a question we ask all of our guests. Steps of Value is a podcast that focuses on the relationship between humans and technology. So I'm wondering, from personally, what is your favorite technological invention and what impact do you think it had on our culture? It doesn't have to be something in healthcare.
Right. Okay, I say this, but it is completely not to be a suck up, and I'll explain why. But I love podcasts. And I'll tell you why. It's my favorite invention because I am a tremendous reader, and I have less time these days to read, and I find podcasts to be an incredibly facile way for me to integrate the same things out of it that I do from reading. I can listen to podcasts that have absolutely nothing to do with what I do. In fact, I don't often listen to very many. I'm very specific about the ones I listen to that are work-related. But I hear those other voices, and I explore those other cultures, and I get those different perspectives. And I can do it on the plane. I could do it in the car. I could do it when I'm going for a walk or a run. So it has allowed me to fill the gap that when I had more time, I could just sit and read in a more consumable way. And I love the human voice part of it, which, not to say that I've given up on books, but just to say that I think podcasts has enriched that part of my life when it comes to continuous learning. That, you know, minus that, I really don't know where I would get it. I'm not a TV person per se, and I spend enough time on a computer. So for me, podcasts have been amazing. And my friends and I often trade lists back and forth of which ones are our favorites at any given time. So in terms of cultural impact, I do think it's a bridging tool. I think the fact that they're free is extremely important. You know, people should certainly, you know, think about how they pledge funds to what matters to them. But nonetheless, it is, like books, something that is available. available for the greater public benefit without a cost, as long as they have something to download it onto and listen to. And I do know a lot of people who talk about them the way they talk about books. And so I think it's expanded that dialogue that we have within our culture, whether it's about politics or, you know, crime stories or storytelling or what healthcare, leadership, whatever it is the topic might be that people are interested in. It brings people closer together when they can find their communities. And it seems like now there's a podcast for every community.
Okay, on the spot, 30-second promo. What's the top fave right now? What podcast are you sharing with your friends?
Well, I'm a big Malcolm Gladwell fan, so I'm very excited that the latest season of Revisionist History has come out. So I really like that one. I really like Invisibilia, which looks at the impact of things in our culture on our behavior. I actually have, I can tell you specific episodes of Invisibilia that helped me make major life decisions and, or at least understand them afterwards. I was like, oh, that's why I did that. I like Terrible Thanks for Asking, because when things aren't going well, people always just say fine. I think it's hilarious that you could say Terrible Thanks for Asking. And there's a community of people around that. Oh my goodness. I like Hidden Brain. You can kind of tell I'm interested in the sort of the brain science of things. With Shankar Vedantam. But I also like Serial and Criminal and those that tell stories. Strangers is another one that's about stories. So I have a long list and I download them for all my travel because I do a lot of travel. And yeah, I'm just very grateful for them.
Well, podcast aficionado Jess Kahn is a senior expert at McKinsey & Company in their Washington, D.C. office. She is a 2018 recipient of the HIMSS Most Influential Women in Health IT Award. Jess, thank you so much for joining us today on Steps to Value.
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Denver. I focus on building collaborative relationships for HIMSS with other organizations to align opportunities to work together to offer resources, education, and to support our shared goals. You're listening to Steps to Value.
How are you using data to impact your own life and those around you? What moments helped you find your voice and a seat at the table? Send us a note as a voicemail or an email and we'll play them on air at the end of our next episode. We'd like to thank our guest, Jessica Kahn, Senior Expert in Public Sector Health IT and Data at McKinsey & Company, for sharing her valuable insights on how data coupled with a desire for impact can affect patients' and providers' healthcare experience. Steps to Value is a copyrighted production of HIMSS. HIMSS is a global voice, advisor, and thought leader of health transformation through health information and technology, with a unique breadth and depth of expertise and capabilities to improve the quality, safety, and efficiency of health, healthcare, and care outcomes. HIMSS designs and leverages key data assets, predictive models, and tools to advise global leaders, stakeholders, and influencers of best practices in health information and technology so that they have the right information at the point of decision. HIMSS drives innovative forward thinking around the best uses of information and technology in support of better connected care, improved population health, and lowered cost of care. Steps to Value is co-produced by Rod Pahowski. Kelly Lippitt is story editor and guest relations manager. I'm Adam Baser, and we hope you join us next time on Steps to Value.